Hi everyone, I'm Justin Chisholm, welcoming you back to the Yacht Racing Podcast. My guest this time is British yacht racing journalist Andy Rice, a regular on the show, who I spoke to shortly after we returned from Enoshima, Japan, where he'd been reporting on the Tokyo 2020 Olympic Regatta for World Sailing. Andy is a veteran Olympic sailing correspondent, so he is well positioned to comment on just how different things were for the sailors in Japan as they coped not only with the pressure of Olympic competition out on the water, but also strict COVID-19 restrictions back ashore. Well, Andy Rice, welcome to the Yacht Racing Podcast. You've been a very, very busy boy. It's good to see you back at home in the UK, but you've been doing some traveling. You're out to Japan for the Tokyo 2020 Olympic Games, taking place, of course, in 2021. Have you recovered at all? You seem to have just been on the road a lot.
It did take a while. I got back from Japan and I had just less than 48 hours in the UK, and I just slumped on the sofa and watched the rest of the Olympics for a day or two until the closing ceremony. And then I jumped on a overnight ferry from Portsmouth across to Cherbourg to catch the end of the Fastnet race, because I was working for the organisers working on that event. And that's, of course, long hours because the boats don't come in during the daytime necessarily. And yeah, I've done a good bit of sleeping since the end of that.
So that's the breadth of the job of being a yachting journalist, from the Olympics and medals and dinghy racing to the Fastnet with some of the biggest, fastest boats in the world, but also some of the weekend warriors as well, also battling away in the same race. So let's talk about the Fastnet a bit later on if we get time. I want to pick your brains about the Olympics. I was set up to go to the Olympics, but COVID and a number of other things prevented me from doing that. But you were out there, so just set the scene for us a bit, Andy. Who were you working for? What was the role? And then we'll get into your experience of the Olympics, because I suspect it might have been a little bit different to many of the others you've covered.
Yeah, different in some ways and in other ways exactly the same. And so I was there in the pay of World Sailing. It was repeating a role that I'd done for them at Rio 2016 as one of their writers. They had a slightly reduced team this time round, so I was the writer, working with a really good bunch of people, best known amongst those probably the Sailing Energy photographers. And in fact, there's three of them, because there were two out in Japan, and then there was Thomas working back in Palmer in your neck of the woods where you normally live, Justin. And so the guys out in Tokyo, Jesus and Pedro, were taking photos on the water, beaming them off their phones straight back to Thomas in Palmer, processing those photos and getting those photos up within a couple of minutes of the start of a race. Anyway, there was a bunch of us, small bunch of us, working for Daniel Smith, the comms director of World Sailing. And if I hadn't had that job, there's no way that I would have been at what's now my fourth Games. You and I worked together. We did a little podcast together during the London 2012 Games. And I remember we got told to take it down because it was breaking the rules of reporting at the Olympics, because we were recording inside the accredited zone. And as you all know, everything is all about whether you're inside the accredited zone or not. And there are all kinds of frustrations that came with this Games and come with every Games. But of course, there were a whole bunch of other COVID-related frustrations with this one too.
I seem to remember we were inside the accredited zone, but that was actually, we were recording it outside in the car park by the bins. It wasn't that glamorous, was it?
No, I mean, that is pretty typical for the Olympics. The most glamorous thing that you can ever say about going to the Olympics is that you can tell people, I've just been to the Olympics.
And, that's right.
You get quite proud when you get handed that. I should have dug my accreditation out, you know. It's the closest I'll ever get to an Olympic medal, you know. But when you're on your way out there and you're clutching your accreditation pass, you feel quite proud of yourself. And then when you're on the BA plane home and everyone else is, you know, skinny as hell, taller than me, and they're wearing medals, and all I've still got is my accreditation pass, makes you feel a little insignificant, but also a little bit proud that you were able to be part of it as well.
So how many Olympic Games is that for you now?
Well, reporting directly from them, that's four. I mean, I've written about every Games since Sydney 2000, but since Beijing 2008, I've been to all of them. And this was definitely the strangest and the hardest to get to. And if I hadn't have been doing that job for World Sailing, there's no way that I would have gone under my own steam. And it was a pretty empty media centre compared with normal Games for that reason. It was super hard to get to. So to give you an example, we had probably at least three or four Zoom calls amongst World Sailing just to get our head in the game of all the different things we had to do, all the hoops we had to jump through. I had to do three consecutive days of PCR testing in Southampton down the road before I could get on the plane. So that was £400 worth of testing before you even got on the aircraft. It was then 5 hours in the airport waiting for a test result and then arguing with the Japanese as to why I wasn't allowed to leave the airport. And then eventually was allowed to leave. And have been led to believe that I wasn't going to have to quarantine when I arrived, but then I did have to quarantine. So I was in the hotel room for 3 days before I could actually go to the sailing venue. And then when I did get my freedom, I always knew this was going to be the case. Everyone did, because for very good reasons, most of Japan didn't want the Olympics to go ahead. Therefore, if the Olympics was going to go ahead, we absolutely had to dot every I and cross every T, which meant I never left, I never went more than 5 meters outside of the door of the hotel. And the only reason I did that was to get onto the bus to go to the sailing venue. And it was, you know, eat, sleep, sail, repeat for 2 weeks. No karaoke bars, not even a trip to the 7-Eleven.
Wow. That doesn't sound like a lot of fun, Andy, I've got to say.
No, I mean, the only thing that was fun was working with the team that I was working with and the drama of the competition, which was amazing. I really don't think that the Olympic regatta was very compromised at all. It was pretty much the same as working in London 2012 down in Weymouth, which I thought was a very sterile experience and not at all interesting in terms of there was no atmosphere at Weymouth and Portland. There was fantastic atmosphere at the Noth for the spectators, and we didn't have an equivalent in Tokyo, as you know. No one did. But the great thing about being in a non-spectator sport like sailing is that when there are no spectators, nothing really changes very much.
Yeah.
So, you know, yeah. I would say it was probably the least affected of any of the sports at the Games because it was just business as usual, really.
Yeah. And we've heard a lot about the fact that the athletes across the whole Olympics, athletes weren't allowed to travel with friends, family, as they might normally do. Talking to the sailors themselves, was that something you discussed with them? Were they missing that element? Or are the sailors, are they more kind of independent perhaps than the other athletes?
Yeah, if anything, the stories I've heard is that when family are around, they can be more of a distraction because they're not normally around at other events that you do in the 4 years leading up to that. So if anything, that probably tends to break your routine, but that's a very personal thing. If you're one of the few mums on the circuit, like when, say, one of the 470 helms, and you weren't able to travel with your young kids and your husband or whoever is helping you with the campaign, anything that breaks your normal routine, I think, is going to be a problem. But I don't think generally that the lack of family there was an issue for most sailors.
So a typical day for you at the Olympics on a race day, I mean, I think a lot of people imagine that as a sailing writer that you're perhaps whisked out on a rib and driven from course to course and You know, you kind of take in the scenes and then come back and wax lyrical once you get to your keyboard. It's not quite like that, is it?
No, not really. Not for me. I had it pretty easy in the sense that I wasn't required to be on the water. And in fact, it was almost impossible for me to do my job if I was on the water, because I always had to get a newsflash story out. And I always prided myself on getting that story out within 60 seconds of the medalists crossing the finish line. So I had to be there literally typing into the keyboard as I was watching the drama unfold. But then for the photographers, they would be out there. And well, for the multitaskers, such as Richard Gladwell from New Zealand and Robert Deves from the UK, the guys that can write really well and take amazing photos, then, you know, they come ashore hot and sweaty, sunburned, and then they've got to process their photos and they've got to get to the writing after that. So, you know, by comparison with their job, my job was pretty straightforward. So, it would be breakfast at 8 o'clock in a separate zone from the local people in the hotel. So we had our world sailing visitors section of the breakfast. So there was no cross contamination. And then masks on, it's masks on at all times. Generally walk out the hotel room in the morning, realize you've forgotten your mask, walk back to the hotel room. I never got used to putting on my mask. We had to wear that the whole time and I hated that. But anyway, you get a bus in and then my writing started pretty much as soon as we got into the media center, having gone through the all the security baggage check, airport style baggage check, which was actually one of the fun points of the day, because all the Japanese would be going, konnichiwa, konnichiwa, good morning, hello. And it sort of turned into this chorus, this sort of dawn chorus of being welcomed by the Japanese, who were absolutely fantastic hosts. So that was nice. And then it was quite a sort of sterile experience in the media center, but I didn't really care because there was just so much drama going on with the racing.
And in terms of the other people that were there, you mentioned Richard and Robert. There's usually a pretty big media contingent just from the sailing media at these sort of events. And then you get the mainstream media. I remember down in London being amazed at just how busy the media center was. And it was a fairly extensive facility. Was it like that this time, or was it pretty quiet?
It was quiet by comparison with what we experienced at London 2012, when on the medal race days you get all these oafs pile in from London from the national papers and just sweep everybody's stuff off the table and didn't give a toss about anybody. And you know, it was dog eat dog, every man for themselves. It wasn't as frenetic as that. It was, you know, there was probably the media center was just as big, but there were always spare tables, and there wasn't that sort of sense of, you know, of it being an absolute scrum on the days when the medal races were happening. So it's all a bit more civilized than that. And, you know, maybe lacking a bit of atmosphere for that. Also because, you know, being behind a mask all the time, it's just quite hard having a conversation, you know, so with people that you haven't seen for a few years, people like Richard or David Brannigan, Clive Mason, the Getty photographer, you know, these guys that you only see once every few years, it's just quite hard to have a, you know, conversation like this. You know, in the end, you just sort of, you don't bother as much because it's just too hard.
Yeah, I can imagine. I think we've all suffered from that generally. One of the things I remember from London 2012 was kind of how limited your access was to the sailors. And sailing were very lucky that generally, even the really big names in our sport are very generous with their time. It's relatively easy for us to get one-on-one time with them. It kind of isn't really like that with the Olympics, because for good reason, I guess. So as I remember, you were limited to the mixed zone, which is the kind of rope line where the sailors are kind of obliged to parade past you. They're not obliged to stop, I don't think, as I remember. And then the press conferences. So is that what happened again in Tokyo, or did COVID put paid to that as well?
No, that was exactly the same. And the only difference was that rather than one cordon between us and the athletes, there were two with a 2 meter distance. So if you wanted your microphone to be anywhere near the face of the person you're interviewing, you actually needed a selfie stick. So a selfie stick was not a glamour tool. It was not a sort of a vanity tool for a change. It was actually a tool of the job. So you'd attach your phone to a selfie stick and reach across and interview the sailors. But as you say, they're not obliged to stop. They're only obliged to walk through that zone. And maybe I read too much into this, but you know, the one snapshot I have every day is that 15 or 20 minutes in the mix zone. And I think you can gauge quite a lot about people's mood and how they're doing by their body language, and also whether they choose to stop or not. And there are the fair weather stoppers that will stop when they've had a good day, and they won't stop when they've had a bad day. And there'll be some that hardly stop ever at all, anyway. And then there are others that will always come and talk to you regardless. And the ones that really impressed me, I sort of call this my Nick Rogers and Joe Glanfield Award, because those two guys, when they were winning their silver medals at two successive games in the 470, I particularly remember at Beijing in 2008, they were having a pretty bad time of it, and they only won that silver medal by the skin of their teeth in the medal race. And it was a medal they probably shouldn't have won a medal at all, but somehow they got a silver. And the thing that really struck me was whenever they walked up to me in the mix zone, I never knew what kind of day they'd had. They had poker faces of basically massive grins on their face. That was their poker face. It was always grinning, whether they had a great day or a crap day. And for me, the Nick and Joe Award for these games went to Dylan Fletcher and Stu Bithell.
Okay.
And I sense of maybe a slight sense of surprise in that okay, because I think Dylan Fletcher was not that character a few years ago. And I think Stu Bithell seems like the glass clown. I think he's sort of from up your way as well, isn't he, originally?
Stu was a GP14 sailor. I've watched him grow up from being a nipper, crewing in GPs and racing against him. So yeah, I've followed his career with great interest.
Well, he is obviously smarter than the class clown that he appears to be, but he always keeps it light. And you could always take the mickey out of these guys at the mix zone. You could have a laugh and a joke with them. And okay, they didn't really have a slip up either. They had a pretty good regatta all the way through, and it's always easier to be like that when you're having a good day. But they just had this sense of, yeah, we're enjoying this regatta and we're going to have fun come what may. And I think that stood them in really good stead for what they ended up achieving. And then there were others where, you know, their poker faces are not good, and you can tell exactly what's going through them. And I have to admit, if I was on the other side of the fence, that's how I would be. I think it either takes a great deal of natural talent or a great deal of hard work to manage your emotions in the way that you have to be a top athlete capable of winning medals. And so I really like that side of the mix zone for seeing who stops and who doesn't, and probably making far too many over assumptions about why that might be the case or not. But it's fun to do it anyway.
Yeah. And when you go into the mix zone at that point, they've just raced. So they've literally pulled their boats up the ramp and they've put them in the slot. They come through the mix zone, and it can be pretty busy, and you could get two sets of people coming through at the same time that you want to interview. How do you organize yourself with all that, Andy? Do you go into it with a plan of who you want to talk to, or do you just take what comes to you?
No, it's always with a specific view to try and get the story of the day. And I was working with two others on the World Sailing Media team, and we would sort of have a plan of who was going to try and grab who. And occasionally you'd be in mid-interview with somebody and you'd see somebody walking past, and I'd be gesturing to one of my colleagues to go and grab them. But that was also one of the tactics of those that didn't want to talk to the media, is like they'd wait and they'd see when the media all were bees around a honeypot, around one sailor, and they'd use that as their moment to try and break past the mix zone and escape us. So, you know, there's a bit of games going on in terms of trying to speak to the right people. But by and large, we mostly got who we wanted, and that worked reasonably well. But I mean, you raise the whole aspect of mix zone plus press conference at the end for the medalists. I mean, it's not always the medalists that are the most interesting story. You know, there are the people that just missed out that you don't necessarily get any great opportunity to interview, you know, such as Robert Scheidt, who came very close to a medal age 48 in the laser but didn't quite manage it. Well, I luckily got my bit with him the day before when it was clear that he was very unlikely to get a medal, and I had my bit with him in the mix zone. But if you don't get those moments at the games, then you probably won't get them at all. And the, how locked down, in a non-pandemic sense, just in a how controlled the media is in the Olympic Games, I find endlessly frustrating. And from a commercial point of view, I've never really fully understood it either. But I'm sure they have their reasons. But it is one of the great frustrations of the Games that sometimes you feel, wow, what is the difference between me being here on the ground and me just being at home reporting on it? And in fact, Ed Gorman was reporting for the Times newspaper in England, watching the TV and writing up the reports from the UK, which, can you imagine if someone had told the Times, the sports editor of the Times 15 or 20 years ago, that that's how they were going to report on the Olympic sailing regatta? I mean, they just would have laughed you out of town. You know, is that where journalism has gone? Well, yes, it is. It is. And actually, there isn't a whole lot of difference in the story I would write if I was Ed Gorman at home watching it on TV, or me in Tokyo writing it in the in the media center, which is a terrible admission, but it's more I'm making a criticism of why is it that we, the media, are so restricted in being able to do our jobs.
And give me an example of the restrictions you're thinking about, Andy, because I'm not sure I fully kind of understand that.
Well, does it just have to be limited to the mix zone? For example, in Beijing 2008, in the Republic of China, not necessarily considered to be the most open and democratic of societies, of the four games that I've done, that's where I've had the most access to the athletes. Being able to walk around the boat park and being able to interview, maybe I wasn't meant to, I don't know, but anyway, I managed to do it. That no one was stopping me doing it. And I could see from an athlete's point of view that would be frustrating. I just think it's very clinical, the Olympics. It's very surgical. Everything is run by accredited zones. There's not much room for organic flow or creativity or sort of bumping into people. I suppose if it hadn't have been a COVID games, the great thing about Enoshima, which we never experienced, was it's an island with a sort of a causeway onto it. And in the evenings, probably the bars and restaurants in that area would have been full of sailors. It would have been a bit like going to the Cove pub in Weymouth at the end of the racing day. And being able to rub shoulders with the sailors and getting the real stories then in a more relaxed environment. And we never had that opportunity because we were, you know, never able to go out to a bar or a restaurant. So I suppose that's not necessarily...
Do you think that...
Sorry, go on.
Sorry, Andy. Do you think that means that those real stories, and I understand what you mean about the real stories, will never get told now because... You know, perhaps we won't be rubbing shoulders with these people anytime soon. I mean, you know, it's the end of an Olympic cycle. People move on to other stuff, unless you and I go and make the effort to get those stories, to arrange interviews, that sort of stuff. Then maybe those stories don't get told.
Yeah, well, that's probably right. I mean, there's probably loads of stories that are doing the rounds within individual teams, or you know, just in the sailing community generally, or maybe that some of those stories will come out the next time they meet at an international regatta like Kiel Week or something like that. There will be lots of background stories that we will have missed. But anyway, I mean, I may be overstating it because it's still a great games, and there was drama in nearly every one of the 10 events. I thought nearly every one of the 10 events had something to offer. Well, definitely had something to offer at some point, and nearly all of the medal races were interesting for one reason or another as well, which is not always the case.
Now, you gave me some pointers before we started this conversation, and I'm going to run through them in no particular order. One of them was yellow flags for pumping. Now, this seemed to be a bit of an issue. It was certainly contentious for the Brits in the lasers, because they, I think, felt pretty aggrieved that they lost out on a strong medal chance there. What can you tell us about pumping in the Olympics?
Well, it's always this sword of Damocles hanging over every slowboat sailor in the games. If you're sailing a slowboat that benefits from pumping, like a fin or a laser, then you know this is part of the game. And it just seems like those yellow flags and where they get pointed always end up being a big determining factor in the outcome of the regatta. And I wasn't aware of what you've just said about GBR. I'm assuming that you're talking about Elliot Hansen.
Was that not a pumping penalty, or was that maybe that was an OCS?
Well, he may well have had, but that's not a particular one that I've heard. But Pavlos Contidas was having a fantastic regatta, sailor from Cyprus, winner of two world championships and the London 2012 silver medal, and he was leading for a lot of the regatta, and he was given his second yellow flag in a race where he was lying second and had to retire from that race. And there were lots of other examples of that. And then the most extreme or the most controversial was the one where Anne-Marie Rindom had already had her first yellow flag. So that's a 720 penalty. And then I think it was in the course of the pre-start, whilst chasing down Marit Bouwmeester to try and lock out the gold medal before the medal race even took place. I think while she was attacking Marit in the pre-start and doing some match race moves, I think she was given a penalty whilst executing some of those moves against Marit. And then she didn't know, the rules, whether she was allowed, when the U-flag recall was brought in and the whole fleet was recalled to restart under the U-flag, whether she was allowed to take part in the restart of that race. And apparently in laser competitions run by Ilka, she wouldn't have been able to do that. But when under world sailing rules, she would have been, or she was allowed to do that at the game. So she can be forgiven for not being fully across the rules, because they're not consistent from regatta to regatta. But still, it was a big miss for her, because she started the race and then you had this all on the onboard cameras. You could see the emotion on her face, which was great shots. And then she pulled out after about 100 metres and thought, oh, I better not do this race, because if I get a third penalty for the Rule 42, it's a DNE, it's a non-discardable race score that I'm going to have to count. So she sat out that race, and it was like she lost any chance of any medal. She was distraught, but it just meant that she went into the medal race with a 7-point advantage instead of a already locked up the gold 27-point kind of advantage. So it put her on the back foot. She still won the gold medal, but if she hadn't have done, she wouldn't have been able to live with herself, you know, for the rest of her life. So that's sort of a related, I suppose it's not a directly a Rule 42 penalty story. The ones that really get me are in the 49er FX, where the US girls, Steph Roble and Maggie Shea, had already picked up a yellow flag for sort of ooching a little bit too much out of a leeward mark. I don't think there'd been any yellow flags handed out in the skiff classes for the previous two or three years, if not more. So they just weren't used to that kind of yellow flag attention. And then they hit the windward mark because there was a bit of tide. And while they were doing their 360, the judge pointed the yellow flag at them. And they said, they thought to themselves, yeah, we know that. We're already doing our 360. And they carried on and finished the race, but then they were disqualified because the reason why he was pointing the yellow flag at them was because the judge had made the judgment that they were using illegal Rule 42 kinetics to get the boat through its 360.
I mean,
that is just so painful. And I feel so sorry for those US girls because they just didn't know what had hit them. They thought that yellow flag had hit them for what they were already doing, not the penalty that they were adjudged to have committed whilst doing their penalty, if you know what I mean. So, you know, that stuff needs to be consistent. You can't just trot up and start handing out yellow flags to a fleet that hasn't experienced that before. So there are some questions to be asked there about how you run that yellow flag regime and whether those penalties are appropriate, you know, whether the penalties are appropriate to the crime as well.
And Andy, I know in match racing, I don't know whether this is a consistent thing, but I've seen in match racing events, you know, back in the day, admittedly, where the chief umpire will run a kind of briefing session before racing starts and say, look, guys, you know, there's new rules have come in play. There's interpretations. I kind of draw your attention to these things that we're going to be hot on this week. So they're kind of, you know, they're trying to avoid these situations where surprises are coming up with penalties. Match racing and is kind of where I've experienced the yellow flag thing more than in normal fleet racing, and I always thought of it as it's sailing's opportunity to go, referee, what are you talking about? You know, that that was never a foul. But I just wonder now whether, after what you've just told us, whether the coaches should have been, you know, maybe they were looking for this sort of interaction with the umpires, whether that would have been allowed, and whether the sailors should have been practicing how to legally do their turns, that sort of stuff. I mean, I'm not saying this now, that's what they should have done, but is this stuff that they will now start thinking about?
Well, in answer to whether those briefings were happening, I hope they were, but I don't know if they were, and I sort of suspect that they maybe weren't, because it's just, again, it's the games, there's so much other stuff going on, and COVID made all those sort of get-togethers harder to do anyway. So I suspect that some of these penalties that were being pointed at people on the water were coming out of the blue, but I may be speaking out of turn. I personally hope that there is a conversation following up on that, that if there are going to be, well, firstly, the sailors should be polled as to whether, whilst they're doing a penalty turn for hitting a mark or another boat, is it fair game to use any means necessary, including so-called illegal propulsion to turn the boat? I think if you did a poll of sailors, I think 99% of sailors, if not all of them, would say anything goes. If you've got a penalty to get done and somebody else who's just hit a mark and has to do a 360, I'm not going to be bothered how they execute that 360, because if I was in their situation, I would just want to get it done. And I hope that the Athletes Commission at World Sailing, which is, you know, the reason why that organisation was formed, I hope that they will review that stuff and that the sailors will have their say, because World Sailing's had a history of listening harder to the judges and to the rulemakers than it has to the people that actually are sailing to these rules and are putting their whole campaigns and lives on the line. They're the people, they're the customers when it comes to the racing rules, not the judges.
Yeah, the judges take a lot of criticism, don't they, online. I'm just thinking with the SailGP event this weekend, which I didn't watch in great detail, but I did see the clips on social media of a disputed penalty on the Brits against the Japanese. I mean, whether it was or it wasn't is kind of irrelevant to this conversation, but people were fairly acerbic about the judges and you know, well, they've obviously never sailed in any sort of competition before, which is pretty harsh when you look at the quality of the judges they've got in SailGP, who absolutely know what they're doing. But it's like, who would be a judge? Who'd be a football referee, and who'd be a judge in sailing?
Well, I was joking with Craig Mitchell, who is the chief umpire at SailGP and turns up like a bad penny at every single event these days. He's the who would be a judge? Well, Craig Mitchell would, because he must be in gold in on his BA air miles. He must be at, you know, gold level. But they're doing some great features, sort of really bigging up the controversy on the Sail GP TV programs. And the one where he judged against, or where Craig judged against Jimmy Spithill, as to whether Jimmy should have been penalised in a coming together with Japan. That was a real, you know, well, Jimmy was saying, well, has Craig ever sailed one of these boats? You know, what does he know about manoeuvring these boats at high speed? And I was joking with Craig. I said, isn't that your perfect opportunity to go for a spin on an F50? I mean, it's there on TV. That's for everyone, right. You know, and actually, serious point, Craig Mitchell is a good sailor. And I think all of the judges would be much better at their jobs if they actually had a spell sailing the boats that they're judging. And I don't know if that ever happens, but I think it should do. At a very minimum, it should happen in the Laser and the Finn, because they're relatively easy boats to sail. But I would argue also that if you're going to judge a boat like a 49er, okay, you're not going to, you know, be able to attain mastery of it, but I do think the judges should have some practical experience of sailing the boats that they're judging.
Yeah. Yeah. It's that's a great idea. I think you're absolutely right. Now, one of the other things you tipped me on your list of things was trapeze harnesses. And I didn't know what you were talking about at that point. What was there, some controversy, some scandal about trapeze harnesses?
Well, yeah, one of the great things about the Olympics is that it only comes around once every 4 years. And so it is that jeopardy of people are putting so much of their lives into this one moment on the world stage. And then there are these moments where people throw it all away for the silliest, smallest of reasons. And so what happened was two 470 teams in the women's fleet were brought ashore at the end of racing one day, and they were check weighed for their clothing, where you dunk it all in a bucket of water and then you hang it up, I think, for 30 seconds or whatever, and then you weigh whatever the remaining weight is of the clothing. And their harnesses, maximum rule allowance of 3 kilos, their harnesses were coming in at 3.1 or 3.2 kilos, and they were both disqualified. The German and the Argentinian teams were disqualified for their harnesses being 0.2 of a gram over. And in one case, it might have even been less than that. Anyway, both races lost that day. As if that's not enough of a warning shot to any trapeze harness wearing sailor, the very following day, the 49er men are check weighed for their clothing. And this time, the Brazilians and the Irish 49er men fall foul of the same rule. And again, it's tiny amounts. And they also lose all their races for the day. So, you know, there's a few things that come out of that. Firstly, is the penalty appropriate to the crime? But also, does word not get around when two teams have been disqualified the previous day? That would you not then double check your kit? It's staggering to me. And I asked the Irish boys about this at the mix zone, and they fully took it on the chin, and they said, yeah, we totally own that mistake, but we did actually weigh all our kit 2 months ago, and we weighed that harness when it was new, but we can only think that as it's got a bit older and a bit more worn and everything's got a bit, you know, fuzzy and woolly, maybe it's just holding the water a little bit more than when it was shiny and hydrophobic and all the water was running off it. So, you know, I mean, there was another coach that told me that he said, right, you're going to check. I take it you've already check weighed your harness this morning, haven't you? And they said, no, it's fine. It's just how I bought it from. I won't mention the company actually, but there is one specific company that comes up all the time as the kind of harness that is close to weight. And no, it's fine. And he said, well, just check it anyway. And they checked it and it was over. And then they had to make some adjustments to the harness. So, you know, even the ones where you've got other people being disqualified, it's not enough to convince people to go and check their own kit, which, I mean, they've made it to the games. You and I haven't, Justin. So, you know, they're obviously much better at many things that you and I are capable of doing, but that one I just find that staggering that you wouldn't sort of take those measures to check your kit when you've gone to all those lengths to get that far.
And especially when the penalty is so strong, and it seems really like over the top, doesn't it? To lose all your races for the day, surely a percentage of points penalty will be more appropriate in those situations. Still going to hurt you pretty badly.
I agree. I do think that there needs to be some proportionality to these penalties, and the ones of blatant cheating where people have been tampering with their NACRAs a few years ago and then getting away scot-free, and then you see people lose all their races in a day because of this kind of oversight. I don't think there's anything more to this than an oversight. It's not an intention to cheat the system or anything. I do think it's really sad that people are penalized as hard as they are, and there does need to be a greater sense of proportionality to the crime, if we can call it a crime.
So who were the other sailors that really impressed you, either medal winners or not medal winners? Because as you say, there's great sailors at these regattas who don't come home with medals.
Yeah, I mean, I think the Laser and the Laser Radial stand out to me as the hardest fleets because there's so much depth. And if you ran those regattas again, you'd probably get very different outcomes. You wouldn't actually. I still think about the people that came out on top, and Matt Wern was runaway better than everyone else. And I remember talking to one of the radial coaches, John Emmett, before that windy day. I asked him what was going to happen that day in the Laser and the Radial. And he said in the Laser, Matt Wern's going to lead round the Windward Mark in both races. And I don't know if he did, but I know that he won both races that day. So, clearly amongst those that know those fleets really well, Matt Wern was known to be a weapon as soon as it was full hiking and depowering. Pavlos Contides, I've got a soft spot for sailors that can rise up to the very top from the small nations, because they've got extra hurdles to get over that the people from the large sailing nations don't have to worry about. So he was very close and didn't quite get a medal. Robert Scheidt, the weird thing was, age 48, you'd think that his weakness would be in strong winds, but actually he was performing at his best in the strong winds, and he was a bit suspect in the light, which I put to him at the end of the regatta, and he was as bemused by that as I was. It goes to show, in fitness terms, his age was not holding him back. So that was really impressive. I could probably go on and on and on from different fleets. Just in terms of interaction with sailors, one that I really enjoy talking to is Marit Bouwmeester, the Laser Radial sailor from the Netherlands. Silver medal in London 2012, gold in Rio, and one of the favourites to get a gold medal here in Tokyo. And she had a shocking start to the regatta, and I mean, it looked like she was out for the count, and then she ground her way back into contention. And then with what happened with Anne-Marie, just losing it with that whole attack on the start line and all that stuff, Marit had got herself back into a position where she might have been able to win a gold medal. But she, she got a U-flag disqualification towards the end of the regatta. So she'd made two big mistakes by then. She'd had a really bad first day, both results in the late teens or the 20s, I think. And then she got a U-flag. And she ended up with a bronze medal, which was an amazing result for the week that she'd had. Anyway, at the press conference afterwards, it was Anne-Marie Rindom, relieved to have won that gold medal. Josephine Olsen from Sweden, who sort of came up, had a quiet week all week and suddenly rose to silver medal. She was obviously always knocking on the door, but I hadn't found myself writing about her an awful lot. But there she was in the silver medal, and Marit Bouwmeester with the bronze. And I asked Marit what the greater sense of emotion was at that moment, 15 minutes after having the medal around her neck. And was it a sense of relief to have come away with some kind of medal, or regret at not having won the gold? And she said, I would have to say the overwhelming emotion is regret. And I apologize to my brother, my coach, everyone that supported me. I feel like I've let them down. And my philosophy on sport is that there is only one winner. There is only one medal. And so I said to her, so the rest of the world now will talk about you as the three-time Olympic medalist, Marit Bouwmeester. How many medals have you won in your mind? And she leaned forward to the microphone and she just said, one. And you could, I mean, you could hear, you could hear a pin drop. It was
wow,
a fantastic moment.
It's so honest, right? That's not done for effect. That's so honest.
She said to the to their PR guy, who you'll know as well, Simon Kaiser, afterwards, that was that too much? You know, I mean, that was her honest response, but. You know, afterwards she was thinking, wow, maybe I shouldn't put that out there. But I mean, that was picked up massively in the Netherlands media. I mean, I was getting phone calls from people in the Netherlands about that interaction that we'd had in the press conference. And it's still running now. You know, it's just not the done thing to talk down winning an Olympic medal. If you get a silver or a bronze, you know, you don't disrespect it. But she is an all or nothing kind of sailor. And let's remember that in London 2012, who was she going out with? It was Ben Ainslie. They were an item. And, you know, it's sort of not a surprise to me that they didn't stay an item, because I don't think you could have two such unrelenting, uncompromising characters in the same relationship. And, you know, so there is an element of the Ben Ainslie about Marit Bouwmeester. And one of the other stock questions I asked at the press conference was, can I have a show of hands? Who's going to be back in 3 years' time for Paris 2024? It's a bit of a rude question to ask when they, you know, the medal's still warm around their neck. They've only just had that one. And now I'm already pushing that aside and saying, well, what about 3 years' time? You know, I feel a bit of an asshole asking the question, but it gets good responses. And in most cases, most sailors would sort of look at each other and think, no, I'm not going to answer that. No, I'm not going. Anyway, so I asked the radial sailors, and two of them sort of just did this, you know, why is he asking me that? And Marit Bouwmeester put her hand up straight away.
Wow, great.
So, you know, she is my favorite to win the gold medal in Marseille 3 years from now, because no one else displays that level of commitment to the cause. It's something to behold.
Yeah, she's a great character, and it's great that we're kind of highlighting her, because I don't see that much about her. And it's really interesting to hear this kind of inside track a little bit from this Olympics. And I was tickled reading your daily reports that you knew what her karaoke song was. I think that was from the last Olympics. And then she said, if I win a medal this time, my karaoke song is going to be this. So yeah, she's good value. She's a good interviewer, right?
Well, she's really, all I see is this ice queen. And I did do an interview with her when she won one of the warm-up regattas in Enoshima a couple of years ago, 2019. So she was able to go out on the night before the medal race and go karaokeing, which apparently she loves. And that's when I found out that her sort of go-to song was Barbie Girl. And so I sort of brought that up with her at the beginning of the week. And that sort of became, you know, that I was always trying to make a connection with her, because she can come across as quite icy. So the fact that I remembered that sort of, you know, created that connection. And so for her to, you know, she said, oh, well, you know, hopefully I'll be big in Japan, she said at the beginning of the week before it all went wrong. That was what she was hoping she'd be singing in karaoke. So yeah, we had that little running joke going. But no, she's normally quite hard to break down and to get through to in terms of seeing the human being on the other side. But from what I hear behind the scenes, when she's not in sailing mode, she's an incredibly caring, thoughtful, how are you, not just about me kind of person, which is nice to hear.
That's great. That's great. And of course, you would remember Barbie Girl, because that's also your karaoke song.
Yeah. You're going to make me blush now, but yeah, you're right.
Maybe not.
No,
I mean, moving on.
Yeah, go on.
I'm going to move on from that silly joke. I wanted to ask you about something which you may or may not have covered on the Road to Gold program that you're running right now. I'm going to let you talk a little bit about that just as a free plug. But one of the things that I'm always befuddled by with the Olympics is how people like Giles Scott and in this event, Blair Took and Pete Birling, hot favourites for the gold medal, can start off so poorly, so kind of lacklusterly. And we've seen it with Ben Ainslie as well in previous events. And you think, wow, is this going to be a massive, this can be a massive shot. They're not even going to make the medal race if they keep sailing like this. And they don't seem to do anything startling. And then suddenly, with two races to go in the qualifier series, oh, there they are, they're in the top 10. And then there they are, they're in third and within 4 points of the gold. And I'm really interested how these people manage to turn around all of that pressure and all of that negative thought, which must be running round their heads. If it was me, I would just be curled up in a ball, sucking my thumb. And yet they turn it into a medal-winning performance nearly every time.
Yeah, and you brought up two good examples where that happened, and two other examples from Tokyo 2020. Matt Wern had a shocking first day in the laser, ended up winning the gold medal with a race to spare. Just no one saw that coming, including himself, after the first day. And Martin Grail and Kaya Nakunza in the 49er FX, they had a pretty awful first day as well. So I don't know why this keeps on blindsiding me like it does you. I've seen this happen so many times, and yet every time I see someone have a bad day, I think, well, you know, it's that old cliche again, you can't win on the first day, but you can lose, and that's what's happened to them. And you write them off, maybe not publicly, because then you do look like a knob. But, you know, you think, no, there's no way they're coming back from that. But somehow they managed to grind that result out. In the Road to Gold program, which I've done with Hamish Wilcox, who's been coach to Birling and Took over the last 9 years, six world championships and the gold medal in Rio and the silver recently in Tokyo, is it's about routines, and it's about staying in the moment. And it's race by race. This is why often really good athletes in any event are quite boring to interview, because what they're trying to do is the opposite of what we in the media are trying to do. When they've had a really good day and they've won all their races, we want to big them up and say, oh, you must be amazed. You know, you must be on cloud nine. How are you going to celebrate tonight? You know, you're probably going to at least allow yourself a beer, and they say, no, we're just going to keep it on the level, you know, just got to take it race by race. And then if they've had a shocking day, and you say, well, how are you going to come back from that? They'll say, well, we just take it race by race, you know, reset. It's the same answer. They're trying to keep themselves in the middle. And in the media, we're trying to drag them up here and drag them down there. But they've got to stay in control of their emotions. And Amaury Rindom was one of the most honest interviews that I had in the mix zone. It was sort of it was a bit of a therapy session for her, actually, I think, to a bit of a release. And so she would be talking about how she's got these voices in her head. Sometimes it's her mum saying, you know, play it safe up the middle. But my dad always said, you know, when you see an opportunity out to one side, you've got to take it. But then I hear my coach telling me this. But then my emotions start getting in the way, and I have to remind myself, who's driving the bus? Am I driving the bus with the emotions in the back, in the passenger seats, or am I allowing the emotions to push me aside and take over the driver's seat and start driving me in the wrong direction? So that was a really, you know, eloquent description of the kind of challenges that athletes have, sailors and other sports people, about using their emotions in the right way. and not allowing the emotions to derail them from where they need to go. But if you can break it down to one thing that these sailors are good at, it's taking it race by race and moment by moment. So every mistake that they made is pushed to one side, it's compartmentalized, and then there's a debrief for that with their coach at the end of the day when they'll go back through those sessions. And in fact, without wanting to break any confidences, I know that some sailors are still debriefing with their coaches in the next few days. They've already had the immediate debrief after the regatta, and 2 or 3 weeks down the line, with a bit of perspective, they're doing other debriefs, because there's so much to take out of a regatta and a high-pressure situation like this, especially with so few competitions to actually train at these days and to get your racing time. You've got to maximise your opportunities from every regatta that you do, but particularly a sort of a one-off like the Olympics. It's about sticking to your routines and doing what always works for you, and going back to that and not being distracted by the bright, shiny objects of somebody else turning up in the boat park with a different make of mast, or some new gizmo on the boat that no one's seen before. Just stick to what you do, because probably if you do that, the wheels will fall off everybody else's wagons around you.
Yeah, and I guess we saw that quite a lot in the America's Cup with Pete Burling's press conferences. I mean, you were virtually quoting directly from him there. If they won, it was, good day, but, a long way to go, just taking it one day at a time, blah, blah, blah. If they lost, it was just exactly the same, with a more positive spin on, the way the boat had been sailed. I think perhaps a lot of the time for the guys who are not up at that level yet, it's just being able to recognize that you're going to have these emotions and you need a strategy for dealing with it.
Yeah, that's exactly it. And I don't know if I can put my hand on the book, but there's the chimp paradox somewhere on my bookshelf, but I can't find it, by the guy that's worked with the British cycling team. And then there's a guy who's it's not even from sports psychology, but his name is Kerry Evans, C-E-R-I Evans, from New Zealand. And he's done a lot of work with the All Blacks and also done a lot of work with the sailors in New Zealand, including Burling and Tuke, and with Hamish Wilcox, who I work with on Road to Gold. And we incorporate some of Kerry Evans's approaches that he's used with the All Blacks into what we do with Road to Gold and the psychology side of that program. It's probably the area that sets people apart. When you look at the tracks of these boats on the analytics, there was really good analytics this time, branded as Omega for the Olympics, but actually SAP Sailing Analytics. It's all there online. You can watch back through every race. And when you watch the 49er races, the Kiwis aren't any faster through the water than anyone else. Generally, they're doing fewer maneuvers, so they're making their tacks and jibes count. But that's not a hard and fast rule either. But you can see that there's not much difference in boat speed, whereas there seemed to be a really fast boat, and it's just that they put themselves in the right place at the right time more often. So sort of taking you a little bit off topic, but so what are the differences if it's not the boat speed that we're seeing is just the same on the SAP analytics? I think it is the mental game. It's the psychology.
So let's talk a little bit, just to round off, about Enoshima as a venue. You spent a lot of time there. You didn't get to go karaoke and you didn't get to go for your curry in the evening. But what was the general feeling about Enoshima as a sailing venue? Did it deliver a good Olympic regatta?
Yeah, it did. We only lost one day to no racing at all. So that was out of 11 days of competition. And thankfully, Thomas Bach, the president of the IOC, didn't turn up that day. He turned up the next day. And because we didn't have any racing that day, it turned the next day into a four-medal race day. And we had some absolute humdingers. We had the Finn medal race, and we had the 49er medal race. Those were the two best ones, I thought. We had the FXs, which were also very good, and the NACRA, which visually is really exciting. I think it's one of the best looking fleets to watch. But actually, the way the medals were working out, there was no real place changing in that one. But even so, the spectacle of the NACRAs was really good. But Thomas Bach showed up in the middle of people being lifted out of the water, still in their boats, doing the, you know, that amazing celebration that's become part of the Olympic regatta over the last 10 or 15 years. And so he really saw sailing presented in the best way possible. And, you know, it felt like the papal visit having Thomas Bach there, and everyone was very excited. Well, certainly in the political world, they were very excited to have him there. But I suspect he was also on a fact-finding mission. Is this worthy of staying in the Games? And if he turned up the day before and he'd just seen the AP flag hanging limply from the mast with no boats going in the water, that wouldn't have been a terribly good advert for the sport. And I mean, the funny thing about working at an Olympics, as you know, is that you know 99% of everything that happened in the sport that you're reporting on, and you know less than 1% of anything else that happened in the Games. So anybody that watched the Games at home on their TV knows more about what happened in the rest of the Olympics than I did. But in that brief period, me being home towards the end of the Games where I went to the Fastnet, I did binge watch it. And I saw the speed climbing, I saw the skateboarding, the BMX riding. And it looked to me more like some sort of Red Bull sponsored X Games that I was watching. And, you know, that these are not sports with a long tradition. You know, they're not harping on about, you know, where are the heroes and, you know, this that keeps alive the Olympic spirit of Ketius, Altius, Fortius that Baron de Coubertin espoused back in 1896. There's none of that. This is a made for TV product. We've got to get the kids on board because we're losing the kids. So that's where the Games is going, whether we like it or not. So what's sailing going to do about it? And for me, there are two things that make sport interesting to watch. One is, does it look good? And the second one is their jeopardy. You know, is something on the line? So the Finn gold medal race was terrible to watch because it was light winds. The boats looked boring as hell in those conditions, but there was jeopardy because that medal, the gold medal, wasn't won until the final few seconds across the finish line. So it ticked one of the boxes, but it didn't tick both of the boxes. When it's windy and boats have the potential to fall over, like I don't know if you saw the first race of the 49er FX, the opening race of the 49er FX. For me, that was the best race to watch of the Games because every jibe for every boat was riddled with risk because it was the wind was bulleting down and it was hitting the sails really hard. And even the best sailors were struggling with it, partly because they'd had 2 or 3 weeks of training in soft breeze and they hadn't really had a chance to practice in that stuff. But there was jeopardy at every turn, just as there is watching one of those BMX races or skateboarding, where you can go wrong in the blink of an eye and suddenly the whole medal table is turned on its head. You know, whether we like it or not, we've got to keep on asking ourselves hard questions about how sailing can match that kind of spectacle, both in terms of the visual presentation of it and the jeopardy of the format. And as I said earlier, I think generally the medal race delivered here, which it doesn't normally to that degree. I think we had pretty good medal races. And it's really hard to ask sailors that put so many years of their life into an even more random format. But we need a format that still has those medals on the line going into the final race. And there are ways of doing that. And we should be experimenting harder with that outside of the Olympics, because I've commentated on some of those alternative formats and I think they work very well.
Okay. So you think different formats rather than different classes of boat necessarily?
I think both, but I think because I rate jeopardy as the number one ingredient for sport, that's the most important thing. The other side of that is I remember watching SailGP in 2019 off the shoreline of Cowes, and it was a really windy day and boats were hitting 50 knots. And then the Brits were having a pretty good day, and then they had a big nosedive, big crash, and then they were out. Their boat was broken and they could no longer compete. And when that happened, most of the crowd watching disappeared. And that was really interesting to me, that it wasn't the spectacle of the boats that would have kept you and me engaged as sailing nerds. They just wanted to watch that Union Jack crossing the finish line in first place. And when the Union Jack was out of the competition, their interest in the competition disappeared, regardless of these Formula One race cars blasting around the Solent. So, I mean, if you've watched Drive to Survive on Netflix, the same thing has happened in Formula One. Now that you understand the characters behind these race cars, you care as much about the people at the back of the grid as you do at the front of the grid, because you've seen the drama and the soap opera. So now F1 viewing figures are at an all-time high, and it's being attributed, well, certainly in the last 10 years, but it's, yeah, that's being attributed to the Drive to Survive effect. So I've talked about a lot of different things there, but fundamentally, it's about jeopardy. It's about caring about the characters that you're watching. And in the case of the Olympics, that doesn't matter so much because you care about the flag. You care about your Union Jack or your Stars and Stripes or, you know, whatever your national flag is. But ideally, you have both. You have the jeopardy and you have something that is visually spectacular. And for me, the fin was not. I don't think the laser is. I think the RSX medal races were awful to watch. And thank God we've got the IQ foil coming in to replace that. But then, you know, briefly onto the fast net, double-handed offshore sailing. I think it's a travesty that World Sailing weren't allowed to carry forward their plan to have mixed keel boat for Paris 2024. I'm sick of watching windward leeward races. There's no real difference to a non-sailor between a 470 and a 49er or a laser or a fin. You know, it's just different, slightly different coloured boats all doing the same thing. And we've got 10 events to showcase everything that sailing is about. It doesn't just have to be endless windward leewards.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I think it's the jeopardy is for the sport of sailing to stay in the Olympics. I think that's the reality of where we are now. I think we have been denied a good opportunity to showcase offshore sailing. I was talking to you earlier about the film that was made of Shirley Robertson and Henry Bombay competing double-handed in a Sunfast 3300 in the Fastnet. It's not the most compelling sailing video you're ever going to watch, but it is a great example of it's 20 minutes that keeps you watching, and it gives you a real feel for what it was like to be on the boat and how exhausted they were and the highs and lows. And you wonder if you could put Leon Sefton and the Ocean Race production team or America's Cup production team on that with a fleet of boats all competing for a medal in Marseille, in the Bay of Marseille, for 24 hours, that would, I think, would be great. And I heard people say, oh, there'll be no wind and it'll just be boring. It doesn't really matter that much because it's going to be about the people.
Totally. It'd be like Big Brother, you know, Big Brother on water. It'd be more about the microphones and the cameras on the boat, inside the boat, capturing those emotions, the moments when they're too tired to actually put on their game face anymore. And you're seeing the real person struggling with fatigue and struggling with stress, and the sailing is almost a by the by to the human drama.
Yeah, missed opportunity, as I put on the story. Andy, I'm looking at the clock. I think we've done it. We always talk about half an hour, 45 minutes. We blow past that without even worrying about it. It's been really useful to get this insight into the Olympic Games. From your perspective, congratulations on the output you produced for World Sailing. I read them every day and published them on the Yacht Racing Life website. And I know they were circulated widely. So well done with all that. It's great writing as ever.
Thank you.
And thanks for today. And let's catch up again very soon, because there's lots of other things we can talk about. But for now, Andy Rice, thanks a million.
Cheers, Justin. Thank you.
that's it for this episode of the Yacht Racing Podcast. My thanks to Andy Wright for taking the time to chat to me, and to all of you for listening around the world. I'll be back soon with another episode, and until then, I'll just say, sail fast, everyone.